San Francisco and Austin, Texas. September 14, 2022. A small team of Cloudflare engineers are scattered across two offices and a handful of home setups, and they're all watching the same dashboard on their screens. The dashboard is a Grafana board, a particular shade of dark blue that anyone who has worked on infrastructure will recognize, with several graphs flickering in the middle. The graphs show, in real time, the global CPU usage across the entire Cloudflare proxy fleet, which is the set of computers that sit between the public internet and roughly one-fifth of every website you have ever visited. Cloudflare's proxies have been running, for years, on a piece of software called Nginx, written in the C language by an engineer named Igor Sisoev starting in 2004. Nginx is genuinely good software. It has handled an enormous fraction of the world's web traffic for almost 20 years. Today is the day Cloudflare is rolling out, region by region, a replacement for it. The replacement is called Ping or Ah. Ping or Ah is written in Rust, and it has been in development at Cloudflare for several years. And the engineers watching the dashboard have spent the last few months getting more and more confident that it will do what they hope it will do. As the rollout sweeps across the world over the course of the day, region by region, the line on the CPU graph tips downward. Not by a little, by a lot. By the end of the day, Cloudflare's proxy fleet is handling the same amount of traffic with roughly 70% less CPU than it was using the day before. The memory usage drops by roughly 67%. The engineers will, in time, publish numbers that become legendary in the Rust community. Ping or Ah handles enough connection work every day that the math, when you add it up across all of Cloudflare's data centers, saves the company hundreds of petabytes of network handling costs per day. They wrote the same software in a different language, and the numbers came out completely different. This is Rust, gently, a patient introduction to how computers actually work and to one particular language for talking to them. I am your host. This is episode 26, The Latency Revolution. Today I want to tell you what changes about the world when the speed of software stops being measured in milliseconds and starts being measured in microseconds. The change is not just quantitative, not just the number getting smaller. It is qualitative, a change in what kinds of software become economically and practically possible. By the end of this episode, you will understand what latency is and why it matters. You will know the famous companies whose products have been transformed by the latency revolution Rust has helped to drive, and you will see why the door this revolution opens is wider than it might first appear. Let me back up and explain what latency actually is. When you do something on a computer, click a button on a website, send a message in a chat app, ask a search engine question, there is a delay between the thing you did and the response you see. That delay is called latency. Some of the delay is the work the program has to do, the database lookup, the calculation, the rendering. Some of it is the network, the time it takes for your request to travel to a data center somewhere and the response to travel back. Some of it is the operating system, the time it takes for the small pieces of the request to be scheduled and processed and assembled. Add all of it up, and you get the total latency the user actually perceives. Researchers who study how humans feel about software have found, more or less consistently for decades, that anything under about 100 milliseconds feels instant. Anything between 100 and 300 feels fast. Anything between 300 milliseconds and a second feels noticeable. Anything over a second starts to feel slow. And anything that takes long enough for the user to begin to wonder if it is broken for 5 seconds starts to lose them. For most of the history of web software, the latency budget for an entire user-facing interaction has been something like 100 milliseconds. Inside that budget, the software has to do everything. The network round trip, the database lookup, the business logic, the rendering, the response. 100 milliseconds is not a lot of time, but it is enough, if you are careful, to do the work of a typical web request. Most modern services live somewhere inside that budget. Now imagine, for a moment, that the time it took to do each step in that chain dropped by a factor of 10. What used to take 10 milliseconds now takes 1 millisecond. What used to take 1 millisecond now takes 100 microseconds. A microsecond, in case you have not heard the word before, is 1/1,000,000th of a second, 1,000 times smaller than a millisecond. When the per-step time shrinks like that, suddenly there is room in the budget for steps you could not afford before. Another network hop to a fraud detection service. A small machine learning inference to personalize the response. A security check to look up the user's risk score. A multi-region routing decision to send the request to the data center closest to the user. Each of those steps used to be too expensive to fit. When the budget loosens, they become possible. The total experience does not just get a little faster. It gets richer. That is what the latency revolution actually is. Not a single dramatic speed up. A loosening of the budget that allows entire new categories of software to come into existence. The companies driving this revolution share a particular profile. They are not, for the most part, the companies you would expect from a generic article about Rust. They are not Rust evangelists. They are not Rust enthusiasts. They are companies whose business depends so directly on latency that they cannot afford the trade-offs the rest of the industry has been living with. And so they have deliberately and carefully moved their hottest code paths to Rust. We have already touched in earlier episodes on the story of Discord in February of 2020, where the chat backend service moved from Go to Rust and the slow tail of requests dropped from hundreds of milliseconds to single digits, and the memory dropped from gigabytes to megabytes. Today, I want to walk through the rest of the list with you. Figma is a design tool that runs entirely in your browser. It was launched in 2016 by Dylan Field and Evan Wallace. Its central technical bet was that multiple designers sitting in different cities could edit the same file at the same time and see each other's cursors moving in real time, the way Google Docs let multiple people edit the same document. Doing this well requires a data structure called ACRDT, which stands for Conflict-Free Replicated Data Type, and it requires the server keeping everyone synchronized to be very, very fast. Figma's multiplayer infrastructure runs partly in Rust, deliberately, to keep that synchronization latency low enough to feel real-time. Adobe agreed to acquire Figma for roughly $20 billion in 2022, partly on the strength of that engine. The deal was later abandoned in 2023 after regulatory pushback, but the engine remains, and it remains in Rust. Amazon Web Services launched in November of 2018 a piece of software called Firecracker. Firecracker is what is called a micro VM, a tiny isolated environment for running customer code. Every time anyone in the world calls an AWS Lambda function, a Firecracker micro VM starts up, runs the code, and shuts down in under a second. According to the original paper, Firecracker can start a fresh micro VM in under 125 milliseconds. A single host can run thousands of them at once. The memory overhead of each one is roughly 5 megabytes. These numbers are what make the serverless idea economically viable at AWS scale. They're also what made Rust the inevitable choice for the project. The team needed C-level speed and the smallest possible startup time, and they needed the safety guarantees of a memory-safe language because the code running inside the micro VMs belonged to thousands of different customers, and the smallest memory bug at that boundary would be catastrophic. Cloudflare's ping, or ah, the proxy we opened the episode with, is the same story in a different uniform. Cloudflare Workers, the company's serverless platform, runs on a similar architecture with cold start times of around 5 milliseconds, an order of magnitude faster than anything anyone had thought possible a few years earlier. Polars, a data analysis library written in Rust by an engineer named Richie Vink, is replacing the older library called Pandas in serious data engineering work because on many workloads it is 10 to 30 times faster. Dropbox has substantial Rust components inside its storage layer The part of their infrastructure that holds the actual files, called Magic Pocket, originally written about in a series of public posts in 2016 and 2017. Microsoft has been quietly rewriting parts of the Windows kernel in Rust starting around 2023, beginning with the text rendering engine and the system call layer, the part of the operating system that handles requests from running programs. The change is not announced loudly, the way the company would announce a new product feature, because the kernel is not a product feature. The kernel is the thing every product feature stands on. The company is quietly putting Rust underneath the floor that the rest of the Microsoft world stands on. The Linux kernel itself accepted Rust code into the mainline tree in December of 2022 in version 6.1, ending a 30-year refusal to add a second language to the kernel. The first production drivers, including a driver for the modern NVMe solid-state disk family and the graphics driver for Apple's own silicon chips inside the Asahi Linux project, shipped through 2023 and 2024. Linus Torvalds, the creator of Linux, who had spent decades skeptical of adding any second language to his kernel, signed off on the change personally. The fact that he did is, in the small world of kernel development, an extraordinary signal. Each of these is a serious commitment by a serious team to a particular set of trade-offs. None of them is romantic. The math came out the way it came out, and the answer was the same language each time. Every one of them gets a smaller latency budget. Every one of them gets memory safety thrown in. Every one of them, when the bill comes at the end of the quarter, is also cheaper to run because faster code uses less CPU and less memory, and at the scale these companies operate at, those savings turn into real money. Not a rounding error. Tens of millions of dollars in some cases, hundreds of millions in others. Engineering decisions at hyperscale are made on math like that. Each of these is a serious commitment by a serious team to a particular set of trade-offs. None of them is romantic. The math came out the way it came out, and the answer was the same language each time. Every one of them gets a smaller latency budget. Every one of them gets memory safety thrown in. For you, the listener, the result of all of this is harder to point at directly. You will not see ping or ah when you open a website. You will not see firecracker when you use a serverless function. You will not see the Polar's library when you use a service that runs analytics on top of it. What you will see, slowly and cumulatively, is an internet where the slowest moments are less slow, where new categories of product become possible, where a chat that used to feel slightly laggy now feels instant, where a design tool that used to be unusable at 3,000 miles distance suddenly feels real time. The revolution is not loud. It is the slow tightening of 1,000 small loops all at once across every layer of the infrastructure you depend on. There's a particular cultural fact about this revolution worth naming before we move on. The engineers driving it are, for the most part, the senior systems engineers of a generation. They spent decades writing C and C++. They were not naive about the costs of switching languages. They had lived through earlier language transitions that did not pan out. When this particular group of engineers of all groups decides that Rust is worth committing to and decides it across many independent companies with no coordination, that is a signal harder to dismiss than almost any other you could ask for. They're not betting on Rust because Rust is fashionable. They are betting on it because, after careful evaluation, they have concluded that the alternative is worse for the work they are responsible for. The latency revolution is, in part, a story about hardware getting faster, and in part a story about a generation of engineers, expert in their craft, quietly agreeing on the same answer. Three things to carry away from today. The first is that latency, the delay between a user's action and the system's response, is the single most important quality of how software feels, and that the budget for it in a typical user interaction is shockingly small. The second is that when the speed of each small step inside that budget drops by an order of magnitude or more, what changes is not just the speed of the existing software, but the kinds of software that become possible at all, and Russ has been at the center of that shift. The third is that the change is hard to see directly, but you live inside it. The chat that feels instant, the design tool that synchronizes across continents, the serverless function that boots before you finish reading the screen, all of these are different in shape because the language underneath them is different. Next time on Rust, gently, we will leave industry behind for one episode and look at something else entirely. We will walk into a building inside the Fort Meade compound in Maryland, and we will look at what happened on a particular day in November of 2022 when the National Security Agency told the American software industry, out loud and in writing, to stop starting new projects in a language that has run the world for 50 years. Until then, take good care of yourself. I will see you in the next one.